This mortal coil.
Well, on this mortal coil at this time on Nightlife, we talk to people about how they get meaning from life and what they believe in. But we're going to talk to somebody who actually studies human behaviour instead tonight. And we're going to talk about happiness and positivity. Positivity has become the new crack of the upwardly mobile and the new pill for the downtrodden and depressed. I reckon that's got to be one of my favourite book openings, I don't know, since Pride and Prejudice. It's a powerful one. The Other Side of Happiness is the name of the book by Dr. Brock Bastian that I'm quoting from. Now, he's an associate professor in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. And in it, he argues that happiness is the new marker of success, but counsels, of course, that we can't have the high without the low. And he joins us now on Nightlife. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, as I've referred to in my introduction, I'm loving the opening of your book. Does relentless positivity drive you insane?
It does, a little bit, yes. I think that was one of the reasons that I suppose one of the places I started with this book was, I think positivity is good, it has its place, but when it gets over-promoted and pushed too hard, yeah, it does kind of annoy me, as you probably could tell from the first line of the book. So, yes. I think it needs to be moderated a little bit, and it's gone probably a little bit too far in some ways and in some contexts.
Mm. And is that damaging for us?
Yeah, it is. And this was actually where a lot of my research first started. I was trained in a certain kind of intervention called acceptance and commitment therapy, and I started to realize that, you know, we would take people into, treat people in a small room as psychologists, and we'd tell them, look, it's really important to accept your negative emotions and your negative feelings. These are a part of life, and that they're important and they're informative, and, you know, we shouldn't struggle with these things. These are just to be expected. And then they'd walk outside and they would be confronted with this culture, whether it's the salient ambient culture that we live in, of advertising and online presentation of ourselves, or whether it's school places or company cultures, and all of the information that was being fed back to people in the broader context was not actually supporting that very important therapeutic principle, which is to be okay, that it's okay to feel bad, it's okay to feel sad, it's okay to experience pain in life, and that's to be expected. Yeah.
And so did this disconnect between what you were trying to help people with in the room, then when they went outside, did it make it very hard for them to actually embrace that negativity and pain because society didn't support it? And did that disconnect kind of stop the solutions and the help you could give them?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've found is, you know, we've started to look at people's perceptions of culture and the what we call social expectations or social expectancies. And this is the concept is the extent to which people feel that they're expected to feel happy and not to have experiences of anxiety and depression. These are things we're expected not to feel. The extent to which people endorse this, we've found, is actually a central feature of depression. When we've analysed it, you know, using fancy, you know, network analysis, we find that in terms of symptoms of depression, this social feature of it is actually quite central and predicts the other kinds of features of depression centrally. So we've also run experiments where we've put people in rooms where they've, you know, been surrounded by happiness paraphernalia, and then, you know, give them an experience where they've failed and watched how they've started to ruminate on that experience, respond to it badly, in a context where they're surrounded by these messages of positivity. So there is a real sort of problem, I think, with overemphasizing the importance of positivity and happiness, because inevitably we all don't always feel that way. Inevitably we all doubt ourselves, we all experience failure in life, we all have blue days, we all feel down. And if we think that the only way we can go out into the world is to mask that with a happy smile and a happy face, it's actually very damaging and causes the opposite problem, which is more depression and more anxiety.
Yeah, which is what we're currently experiencing in our society.
Well, that's right. And I think one of the crazy things is that, you know, the rates of depression and anxiety in our country, in Australia right now, is somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5. This is an epidemic. And when you look at epidemics, you don't just treat individuals. You don't just give people medication. You look at the environmental factors. For example, when we look at things like obesity, heart disease, things like this, we look at the fact that, you know, that the fast food is very prevalent in our culture, and we've started to think what's the role of making fast food readily available to people in terms of their health. So we're looking at these environmental factors and how they impact on people, and I think we need to start to do that as well with mental health, and start to think about the cultures that we are creating and the cultures we live in and how they impact on us, because mm-hmm. it's not just an individual problem.
So what's our fast food that's making us so down? Is it happiness? Is it this sort of fast food version of, you know, you can buy the happiness?
Probably the crux of it is this idea we should seek out happiness. And, you know, there's a very basic psychological principle associated with goal pursuit, which suggests that if you set up a goal in life and you work towards it, you assess your success towards achieving that goal. And, you know, at various stages, you'll feel a bit disappointed because you maybe haven't quite achieved the goal that you were set out to achieve. But that disappointment feeds into, you know, furthering your efforts to work harder to achieve that goal. But when that goal is happiness, you know, that assessment, that disappointment that you're not always as happy as you wish you would be, actually pushes you further away from the goal of happiness and makes it a very counterproductive kind of exercise. So our internal emotional world is far more ironic than our external emotional world. And when we set up goals internally, it tends to be counterproductive and produce exactly the opposite effect that we're trying to achieve. So I think that this
notion...
But modern
business runs on setting goals. Like, that's how most workplaces run now, and schools. And that's what we're told to do in life.
Yeah, just don't make them psychological goals. States of happiness, you know, states of thought or cognitive states. You know, these are not things we can set up as goals in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
But we are told, you're right, we are told often that, you know, there's a great importance placed on trying to build happiness in the workplace, for example. Or, you know, David Cameron had a great campaign in the UK where, you know, sort of starting, and they're still going, I think, to compare the states, you know, the various different regions in terms of their happiness levels. You know, this means if you've had a bad day, you've not only, you know, brought yourself down, you've brought your entire sort of, you know, region down in its levels of happiness. So, yeah, I think that I think it's great to have goals. They just shouldn't be psychological ones like
right.
that.
Now, I mean, you do say, Brock Bastian, that we're sold happiness in our society, and yeah, it should be a goal. But I mean, really, you know, people like Buddha told us, you know, 500 years before Jesus, that expecting happiness is our problem and life is suffering. And there is a return to things like the principles of Buddhism, which is one of the fastest growing belief systems in the world. So how does that reconcile with what you're saying? What's different?
I think that a lot of the principles of Buddhism are very much in line, and I think that there is a more balanced view. In fact, our research shows that in the in Eastern cultures, you find rates of mental illness, depression, anxiety are significantly lower than the rates of those same things in Western cultures. But it's not that people experience less negative emotion in Eastern cultures. It's just that we're seeing that it doesn't translate into a disorder. It doesn't translate into a mental illness. And so people are responding better to their negative emotional states in those cultures compared to in the West. So, yes, I mean, certainly I think there's a lot of tools in the East that we are starting to import into the West to learn how to better respond to, you know, our unpleasant states, to recognise that life is a balance between these two things. Mm. But there is still this very, you know, ambient culture where I think, you know, again, things like mindfulness, which has been brought across in many ways from Eastern practices, you know, it's still this state of trying to achieve kind of, you know, inner peace, but in a very sort of positive way where we're trying to achieve inner happiness, for example. So we still have this kind of one-line directional thinking around where we should be heading with our happiness in life.
Yeah, so our problem's not pain and sadness, but just how we respond to it.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, the fact is that we have pain and sadness in life, and yeah, our response to it is amplifying that. It's making it worse. You know, fearing pain is, you know, amplifies the experience of the fear of pain is worse than pain itself. We know that. So yeah, it's very much our response to it and how we think about it. And I suppose in you know, it's not only just sort of saying, look, we need pain in life to experience happiness. I think it's also going into, so what are the benefits? What's the value of these negative experiences? We're told the value of these positive experiences constantly, and then we look at these negative experiences and we think medication, which doesn't give us very many tools to respond adaptively to these things. So what are the values? What are the sorts of things that they can do for us? And I guess that's what I, you know, what I sort of tried to write into this book.
Set out to do. The book Dr. Brock Bastian is referring to is The Other Side of Happiness, Embracing a More Fearless Approach to Living. He's an associate professor in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Yeah, it's kind of like the Divinals said, it's a fine line between pleasure and pain, and many other philosophers, as you point out.
Yeah.
So what do we need to do about accepting pain? Do we also need to expect it?
Well, yes, expected, of course. I mean, it's going to happen. We we're talking. We're using the word pain here, but I'm really thinking about that in terms of the opposite of pleasure. So we need to, you know, see it in its broader context. So yeah, I think we obviously we need to expect it. I mean, one of the interesting things is that we actually seek out pain far more readily than we realize. You know, a lot of the rewarding, meaningful, purposeful, challenging, even pleasurable pursuits that we engage with in life require us to engage in pain, right from eating chilies, which, you know, is a kind of very, very popular form of pain seeking, if you like, that people indulge in, right the way through to running marathons. You know, I don't think that people would run a pain-free marathon. There'd be no point to that. Right the way through to engaging in a challenging course of study, for example, where, you know, we feel a sense of great reward at the end, but the only reason we feel that sense of reward is because we could have failed that course. You know, we had to try not to fail it. You know, the presence of failure is what made the experience of passing so good.
And the end of the pain, I suppose.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So that's a very important point. It's, you know, it's actually often the sense of relief that comes afterwards and the offset that pain provides for us in life, which is something that increases and enhances our experience of pleasure. And you can't sidestep that. I think that's the important point. You know, Aldous Huxley looked at a society which had tried to sidestep pain by numbing it always and just experiencing a sort of banal pleasure. And, you know, that was a pretty dystopian future from his perspective.
That's with the soma.
Soma, exactly.
Yeah, and you equate that to Xanax now?
I think you could. I think you could have a shot at that. Yes, there's certainly Xanax or any. Yeah, I mean, certainly to the extent that people are overusing it. I mean, these medications are very important for people who need it, and you know, I've seen plenty of people who require it and are able to, you know, operate in life better because these things are there for them. But I think we are using them more and more and more. And so that's something to be considered. Yeah.
I mean, the other side of that is that, you know, you say pleasure and pain sort of at the same brain pathway. A lot of people that self-harm feel an absence of anything. They say that they don't feel anything in life, so they feel they want the pain to make themselves feel something.
Yeah.
How does that fit within your thesis?
Well, I think that, you know, an interesting study was where they actually left people in a room with nothing to do and nothing to occupy themselves with, and people actually chose to give themselves electric shocks in that context. These are normal people, because sometimes experiencing a small electric shock is actually better than, you know, being completely bored and numb.
That's bizarre. Well, because at least you feel you're alive, or
I think sometimes being left with our own thoughts is actually a far worse experience itself. So, I mean, pain sometimes, well, people self-harm for a number of reasons. And you know, one of them is that our physical pain actually does drag us out of our states of emotional pain. It provides a sort of analgesic response to that in some sort of way.
Because there's so much existential pain. Mm.
That's right. So people do, you know, it does drag us away from our sort of internal sort of thoughts and into the world. It makes us sort of engaged more with what's happening here and now. So that does actually work in that kind of way. Of course, the important point there is that it's the pain which is doing that, not the harm. The harm actually leads to feelings of guilt and remorse often after people have cut themselves. So it's not an effective way. But what would be a more effective way, and what achieves exactly the same goal, would be to, say, for example, in, you know, engage in some intense exercise, go to the gym, engage with pain, but in positive ways, through positive pursuits, and you actually will find you get the same benefit, and without the harm. Yeah.
Yeah, and you also talk about why people engage in S&M sex along this same lines. What's that about?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting how pain seeking, or people who seek out pain, it's often sort of cast as, in this interesting sort of, we suspect people who do this. We think they're suspect. But when you sort of look at what our everyday behaviour is, and how in many, many contexts we're all seeking pain in many cases. We're all in many of our day-to-day, we just don't realise it. Again, people don't say, I run marathons because I love the pain. But if you challenge them to think about a pain-free marathon, they probably wouldn't run it. So there are many, many examples in life where we like sad movies, we like scary movies, we engage in drinking bitter tastes like coffee, and, you know, as I said before, eating chili. So there are many sort of.
There is no pain in coffee. I mean, you lost me there.
it's inherently a negative experience. It's a very, it's a very sort of, I guess, mild form of a kind of inherently negative experience that we enjoy. But, you know, engaging with fear fun parks and things like this, so we're always seeking out these experiences because they do actually provide a range of, positive benefits and sometimes increase our pleasure and enjoyment in life. So I think that, often we forget that, and then you look at people who do seem to seek out pain, and we tend to look at it in the area of sexual masochism, and it certainly gives the idea a bad name. But one researcher has come up with the notion of benign masochism, which sort of captures these other kinds of lesser forms of pain seeking that perhaps we all engage in quite frequently and commonly.
Right. You, one of these people who believes that, yes, this generation coming up are a snowflake generation, that parents have been too overprotective. And so this generation is finding it even harder as they grow up to deal with disappointment and pain in their life. Is this actually proven? Because every generation always thinks that the younger generation's, too wussy and says, when I was young, there's that whole Monty Python skit about when I was young, we lived in a box, and, it gets worse and worse and worse. Is it true that this generation really are different?
I am not sure. I mean, we're certainly seeing rates of depression and anxiety go up, but we're also seeing that across the board. So I'm not sure that there is solid evidence that this generation is worse than any other generation. Having children protected from every kind of hardship in life isn't going to set them up for life. It isn't going to provide them the tools to respond to life effectively. Loss or failure, even social exclusion, these sorts of very uncomfortable and difficult experiences in life, if we don't know how to respond to them adaptively and effectively through exposure, by building our, building our psychological immunity to these things, then I think it's very fair to say that we will do worse and respond worse. There's a really interesting study. I mean, everyone knows Martin Seligman, the sort of father of positive psychology, and he started with this theory of learned helplessness, where he put rats, he'd expose rats to an electric shock and then expose them a second time, and on the second time they just sort of give up. And he called this learned helplessness, where you just sort of give up in life, and that, he saw it as the basis of depression. Another group of researchers after that, they did the same study, but they exposed those same rats to repeated instances of electric shock and cold water prior to, to putting them into that same context. And when they were trained in this sort of way, the rats didn't give up. They didn't respond. They responded much better. So there is this notion that exposure to difficulty in life definitely builds resilience and allows people to respond more adaptively. Whether or not the evidence is there, epidemiologically, in terms of, rates of depression and anxiety, I think that there's mixed evidence for that going up in younger people.
But that could also explain the graph where, yes, as you said, positive wealthy countries, higher rates of depression, because we have life too easy.
That's right, in
our material comforts. We haven't developed enough resilience and facing hardship. So what do you say to your kids when they have a bad stack or hurt themselves or something terrible happens?
Yeah, I mean, my first sort of inclination is to rush forward and you know, pick them up and sort of make sure they're okay. But sometimes I also stand back and let them manage it themselves and, you know, see how they respond to it. So I like the idea of them taking calculated risks in life. If I look back at the sort of calculated risks I could take as a child, and perhaps, you know, the ones that my dad tells me that he took, you know, if I was to let my kids have that kind of freedom in this world today, I might get into trouble legally even. I think there's certainly a culture around parenting which suggests we shouldn't be letting our kids walk around the streets anymore like we used to. What's incredible though is that actually the evidence suggests the world is getting safer.
Yeah.
Rates of crime against children are actually dropping quite substantially. And there is good evidence for that. So, you know,
Kids in my suburb wander the streets. I think that's sort of an inner city thing that people believe they don't anymore. It depends where you live.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe that's true. And maybe the extent of your, or how far they go. But look, I think
their radius is smaller.
I think so. And I think that's partly because of media. You know, we're exposed to, we see these horrible things on the news, and then it feeds into our anxieties. It's not that they're more prevalent; we're more exposed to it.
Mm. Yeah, but in that way, we have more exposure to others' pain, perhaps, don't we? Rather than our own, perhaps.
Well, in that way, I think I'm not sure if that's quite the same thing. That, you know, I think that it makes us feel worried about our safety. I'm not sure that it's the same thing that we would build resilience from, though.
So, what's the answer in terms of our attitude to pain? That you see it as learning to? Do we learn to love it? Do we learn to stop running away? How do we train ourselves, perhaps, to recognize that pain can be useful and helpful in life?
Well, I think it's about firstly just having a conversation around the other side of it, and that's what I've tried to achieve in this book. And look at the way that pain can, you know, it's not only that it sometimes, you know, it can toughen us, it can sometimes release more pleasure in life. It also builds social connections. You know, our research shows that when people share pain, they feel more bonded, they cooperate together, and you see this evidence. You know, I was living in Brisbane during the 2011 floods, and I saw the level of community engagement that happened in response to that was really quite awe-inspiring. You know, pushing ourselves outside our comfort zones, often for the benefit of others too, where we get that sense of purpose and meaning in life. So seeking pleasure is not going to provide that, but going and doing something which is hard, which is difficult, but which perhaps has other kind of meaningful outcomes, is very good for our well-being.
In the other thing I think is interesting, you talk about self-esteem, and this goes in with the beginning where we were talking about being relentlessly positive. The other big thing in our society is we worship people who have and seem to indicate they have strong self-esteem. Not only are they positive all the time, but they feel great about themselves. I'm amazing. Listen to me. And we do set those people up on a pedestal. What's the downside of this?
The evidence has suggested, I think in California, there was a real push, the self-esteem movement. And really there was this sort of belief that self-esteem was this panacea, that if we all just thought a lot more positively about ourselves, it would fix a lot of society's problems. So they put a lot of money into building self-esteem. And an evaluation of that, which came out, in the last sort of 10 years, suggested that really the major sort of contribution of this whole self-esteem movement was that people just thought about themselves more positively. It didn't seem to have any other kind of, you know, benefits in their lives at all. They weren't less likely to get pregnant young, or not to use drugs, or to be more pro-social in society, or to do any of the kinds of things that really probably was, you know, the end goal there. They just thought they were better people, which is not necessarily what we want to prime our children to probably see themselves as. So, you know, better than others at least. I think at the end of the day, there's not a lot of benefit to self-esteem. Certainly no self-esteem and very low self-esteem is a problem, but trying to boost it, trying to think that we're better and better people doesn't seem to work. I think what's more important is that we have more of a grounded sense of ourselves, that we see ourselves as part of a community, that we understand our interconnections with others, and that we have sometimes responsibilities there. And I think that is a view of the self which is quite conducive to being engaged with our lives, with people around us, with things that are meaningful. constantly seeking a more positive view of the self doesn't tend to do much more than breed probably just a good level of narcissism. And certainly there's been other psychologists who've talked about, the narcissism epidemic. People who feel the need to see themselves as better than others tend to be fragile.
Yeah.
They tend to take knocks badly. I mean, I think that the difference between being on a pedestal and being grounded kind of I think illustrates exactly that notion.
Mm, yeah, I try and tell my daughter that. Those kids that you think are totally got it together and who absolutely love themselves and who are quite narcissistic, it's on shaky ground. But it's hard to understand that when you're a teenager.
No, very, very hard. And I think one of the interesting things is that I'm pretty sure that that when you go out there and you're a little more authentic with people and people who have the guts to sort of say, look, I've been feeling bad. I'm feeling depressed today. I feel very anxious. I don't feel like I'm coping too much. People respond to that really positively. We've seen it time and time again. I mean, obviously you need to choose the people you sell that to, but broadly people respond very positively because it opens up a conversation for them, and they can then be more authentic with you about who they are. And these are people who are leaders, not people who are sort of falling behind because they somehow have a negative experience in life. We all do. It's just that some of us aren't very authentic with it. And I think that the real leaders are people who are authentic with those things and are able to communicate them to people around them and to be open about it. And it just it kind of takes the pressure out of the room. People can feel able to be themselves, and that actually, I think, allows people to perform better. It allows people to to learn better. It allows people to socialise better. It really has a lot of benefits, but it takes a lot of guts to go out there and say, look, I'm not feeling great. I'm not on top of my game. I'm not, I have self-doubts, those sorts of things.
Yeah, but I think we need to be often suspicious and aware that a lot of people who are relentlessly always positive are usually hiding something, because no one's ever without pain, are they?
No one is. Well, you'd be very suspect if someone ever was, I think, yes.
Totally. All right. Well, look, thank you so much for talking to us about this tonight. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Brock Bastian, an associate professor in the School of Psychological Sciences at the Uni of Melbourne, and his book is The Other Side of Happiness, Embracing a More Fearless Approach to Living.
You're with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.